Hello, welcome to another episode of History Hack. I'm really excited today. I'm always excited. I'm excited. I've actually got a friend of mine on board today. We are going to chat loads and loads and loads of World War II stuff. Yay. So I've got with us Camilla Damlund, who is a Danish conflict archaeologist specialising in World War II Danish naval defences. Hi, Camilla.
Hiya.
I'm so excited. This is finally, you've been following my work. Now we get to talk about yours.
Yeah, which is incredibly nerdy, but you know, let's do it.
Oh, I love archaeology. But listen, what, so guys, before we actually got onto this podcast, we've been, and I thought we should actually record this, we've been chatting about the difference between conflict versus battlefield archaeology, which kind of falls into my field as well, so military history style kind of thing. I don't know, talk to us, Camilla. Tell me the difference.
So the original thing was kind of battlefield archaeology. It is what it sounds like. It's the archaeology of battlefields. But in the last maybe like 20 years, there's been a much wider definition coming out, which is conflict archaeology. Now, battlefield archaeology is a subset of conflict archaeology. So conflict is so much more than just what happens on the battlefield. I mean, A, civilians have an experience of conflict as well, but even B, for soldiers, you know, they're not, the moments they spend on the battlefield are not the be all and end all of their conflict experience. There's this whole lead up to being in battle. There's a whole training scenario. There's living in barracks. There's adjusting to new life as soldiers. And then, you know, there's the battle, sure. But then if they're lucky, there's an aftermath. And that can be, you know, being wounded, what that entails. It can be being prisoners of war. It can be, you know, anything. And that, I think, is really important. I think it brings a different aspect. And I'm not saying that battlefield archaeology isn't valid or isn't important. It totally is. It's just that it's not the be all and end all. That there's so much more to conflict archaeology than just focusing on that, those brief moments on a battlefield.
No, I totally get that. So, for example, in my field, military history, it's not all just about the battlefield experience. I mean, I totally, totally suck when it comes down to formations and this and then.
Same.
Oh, I can't do it. But when you're talking about the soldiers, you're talking about their experience. Like, for example, during the Warsaw Uprising, I'm so interested about how they lived, what they did, what the women did, how, what kind of role the women played. Then obviously you've got the dark side of it. So you've got the massacres and this, and it all kind of interlinks with each other. And it's really interesting. And I absolutely love that kind of personal experience. So more, I would say more the social side of military history. That's what I prefer.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think there's a push in, even in battlefield archaeology, to focus more on individual experiences. There's certainly people still doing, you know, movements of armies and that kind of thing, but there is a focus on very individual experiences as well. There's one artifact, I think it's in a World War One trench somewhere in Flanders, where you can see that this one soldier has like pushed his ration tin into the sandbags, and you know, just as he was going over, that kind of little experience is coming out a lot, and I think that's really cool. But that's still very much focusing on the battlefield, and like you talk, you know, about the social side of it, I think it's really interesting as well. Women's experiences, civilians' experiences, and I think that's really, really fascinating.
Right, okay, we are not here to talk about our battlefield experiences or conflicting experiences. We're actually here to talk about your research. So let's start with the first question, because we're going to be talking about Denmark. We're going to be talking about World War II. Yep. So set the scene for us. First of all, when was Denmark invaded and what did the invasion look like?
Well, so Denmark is invaded on April 9th, 1940, as part of Operation Weserübung, which included the simultaneous invasion of Norway too. And the overarching strategy, strategy is a simultaneous efficient attack on numerous targets. And the reason Denmark and Norway, or the Danish and Norwegian governments, are given for the invasion is that it's a protection of these neutral territories against an Anglo-French attack, which, I mean, accurate, but in reality, like, Norway has important ore, and Denmark, because we share a land border, I mean, A, we're an important stepping stone to Norway, but because we share a land border with Germany, they also really didn't want the Allies to have a foothold in continental Europe once they'd been routed from France, because that could turn out to be like genuinely fatal.
It could end up with an invasion.
They could, exactly.
Right, okay, so I'm trying not, I shouldn't laugh in this point because it's not funny, but 2 hours after the invasion, 2 hours, what happens?
Yep, that's when the Danish government capitulates, and it basically accepts an offer of a so-called peaceful occupation. And to understand this, I need to point out that Denmark is spectacularly flat and has really good infrastructure. So this already makes it easier to overrun than somewhere like Norway, which has fjords and mountains and stuff. But in addition to this, the German forces vastly outnumber the entire Danish armed forces at this point. So by like 6 a.m., the Germans have taken several vital points like Copenhagen Harbour, the Storstrøm Bridge, the fortress of Mesnelø, which incidentally is the site of the first ever deployment of Fallschirmjäger, paratroopers. They've taken important airfields, and basically it's done. Like there's no coming back from this. The spectacularly ill-prepared military forces have been overrun, and the government really at this point sees very little point in prolonging the fight and delaying the inevitable. So this offer of a peaceful occupation is accepted. And what the peaceful occupation means is that the occupation of Denmark will be purely military. So the civilian administration is left in power rather than being overtaken by a German puppet government. And this is really, really important because the Danish wartime experience is very much shaped by this. The German desire to maintain this peaceful occupation means that the Danish government has so much more influence than you see elsewhere in occupied Europe. The general conditions for the people are much better, and as a rule, the occupying forces are not as brutal. Saboteurs are punished by the Danish police force rather than the occupying power, and this means obviously more leniency. And this is also why the Danish Jewish population was essentially left in peace until the end of the cooperation policy in 1943. So we had an extensive resistance network in place by the time we had to smuggle Jews out of the country.
That's really interesting. That actually came up on another podcast when we were talking about the British setting up a resistance network. And obviously then I had to compare it to Poland because, well,
what you do.
Exactly. And it's just really interesting because, again, Poland had to start the resistance network then and there, bang on. They had no time to prepare, no time to get anything ready. And it's just so incredible how Denmark had that time to prepare to get themselves sorted.
And that's exactly it. Like the resistance network is not that strong in the beginning. It's not that widespread, but at that point it's mostly just like being an inconvenience to the Germans more than, you know, bombing shit and smuggling Jews out of the country. That only comes, you know, mid-war, at which point the resistance network has been in place for 2 years.
I'm loving it. So I've got a really random question. Do we know what the population was of Denmark at the time?
I think it was like 4 million.
So basically, yeah, a quarter the size of London, right?
Shut up.
Sorry.
It's not the size that matters, Alina.
I had to throw that one in. No, it's actually really interesting because when you look at the population size of Denmark, for such a big place, you've got not so little people. I think that's the wrong way to say it, but your population is more not so densely populated. It's what's the word for it? Sparsely populated. That's the word I was looking for.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I love how you say such a big place because I can drive like 3 hours and then I'm out of my country. Actually, where I live, I drive 1 hour and then I get on a ferry to Germany. But yeah, I mean, we have our urban centres and then everything else is just fields and tiny towns. It's great.
So perfect for resistance.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, flat ground also means it's easy to drop weapons, except a lot of the places where people with the Allies dropped weapons were in Jutland. And there's a lot of bogs there. So if you miss, you just like drown the weapons. It's great. That did genuinely happen.
Like, whoops. Yeah. Let's not talk about Jutland. Let's move on very quickly away from that.
Well, just because your grasp of geography isn't that great.
Yeah, that I only found out Jutland was in Denmark. What? Oh, God, a few months. No, anyway, moving on very swiftly. Let's talk more specifically about your research. So we've got the background. We know what's happening. Denmark is under occupation. Right, let's get to the archaeology stuff. So your research, tell us, first of all, what is the Atlantic Wall and how does that come into all of this?
Well, so the Atlantic Wall is this massive defense network which stretched from the Pyrenees on the French-Spanish border to the very northern tip of Norway, basically a defense system protecting the entire western coast of occupied Europe. Some of the structures are in place from the beginning of the war because that makes sense, but the Atlantic Wall as a concept has its nascence in December 41 when Hitler issues Directive 40. Demanding this construction of this defense system. He's starting to get worried at this point for several reasons. Firstly, the failure of the Luftwaffe to gain air superiority in the spring and summer of 1940, which means the failure of the planned invasion of Britain. Secondly, the failure to defeat the Soviet Union before the winter of 41, tying up enormous resources on the Eastern Front. And then finally, the entrance of the US into the war in December 41, which gives Britain an ally. So because so much of the machine of war is tied up in the East, Hitler wants to protect the West with a fortification system on which, and I quote, the Allies could batter themselves to destruction, which is total propaganda because it wasn't nearly that indestructible.
So let's talk about, well, why is the Atlantic Wall so special in Denmark?
Well, this kind of goes back to the peaceful occupation. So because the Germans want to maintain the state of affairs, they're willing to negotiate with the government or just straight up do things differently. And this means that while Organisation Todt was in charge of the construction of the Atlantic Wall in Denmark, as well as elsewhere, instead of using forced labor, like it was the standard throughout most of the rest of Europe, the work in Denmark was contracted out to Danish construction companies. So in Denmark, these structures are a reminder of the war, but they're not connected to this really dark heritage because even though they were built at the behest of the Germans, they weren't built by the Germans and forced labor wasn't used. And they were also never actively used. You know, they were there to protect against an invasion, but that never happened. So there's not really any bloodshed in that sense. And it's not like the occupation of Denmark was known for the bloodshed anyway.
Find that really interesting that there was no slave labor used to construct this and it was all done by local workers, basically.
Yeah, and I mean, this is the biggest construction project in Danish history because it employed something like 90 to 100,000 people over the course of the war. And like I said, you know, 4 million people, like, that's a huge part of the population. And in the beginning, especially before the end of the corporation policy, this was just a job. After the end of the corporation policy, it's a little bit more complex. There's a lot of work being done on collaboration versus cooperation and, you know, when does one become the other. But ultimately, you know, this was a construction project.
Okay, so what happens? Well, clearly Denmark isn't invaded. So that's a fail. But what happens in bunker? Sorry.
Rude?
It's okay. Don't worry. Right. Well, no, it's a good thing that Denmark didn't get invaded, isn't it?
No, we want to be invaded by the Allies. Hello? We're already invaded by the Germans. Yeah. Why are you ever just bombing us? That's all we get out of that. Well, and shipping us weapons, to be fair.
Okay, that makes kind of, okay, so you want the Allies to get invaded. My God, I can't even talk today. You want the Allies to invade you. You don't get invaded. Mm-hmm. So these bunkers pretty much don't get used. So what actually happens to them after the war? Are they abandoned? Are they dismantled?
Well, I mean, the Germans leave the country after the capitulation on May 5th, 45, and they're basically either driving or walking back to Germany. And in the beginning, you know, everyone breathes a sigh of relief and they want to just get on with life and get out of the shadow of war. And these bunkers are kind of really obvious leftovers of the war, a blight on the landscape, a reminder of these dark years and so on. And so the initial plan is to blow them up. The problem is bunkers built to withstand a military invasion tend to be kind of hard to blow up. Who knew? Yeah. So about, you know, as early as July 45, there's this suggestion in the press that these bunkers might be used in a musealized way, at least until they can be demolished. And the point there is that the ideal solution is very much to get rid of them, to remove them from the landscape entirely. At this point, the bunkers are, like I said, a blight on the landscape. They're very much just remains from the war, something you want rid of. The idea to open them up to visitors is a secondary idea to make some kind of use of them while they're there anyway. The intention to demolish them is inherent, even in the suggestion of opening them up to the public. It's very much sort of, you know, until we can destroy them. And it's also done from this perspective of, like, these are tourist attractions, they're curios. It's not from a belief that there's any inherent value in the bunkers preservationally. But like I said, they proved kind of hard to blow up, so they never did get demolished. And so time passes and they become more and more part of the landscape. And in the 80s and 90s, there's this suggestion from historians that the bunkers might be used to more actively tell the stories of the war. This is still, at this point, kind of a secondary consideration, like, well, since we couldn't get rid of them, let's actually use them for something. So it's still not really an acknowledgement of any preservational value. That part hasn't really changed from the 40s at all, but the audience has. So they're preserved by accident, and now they're useful in framing stories of the war for an audience who didn't live through it. You know, they're not people who might have a curiosity about what the Germans who have, you know, been wandering around their country for 4 years were up to. It's in the 40s, there's this intent of showing the off-limits areas to the Danes. Now it's more of a question of communicating a historical narrative. So the 80s and 90s are where you start to see this shift in the discourse surrounding the bunkers. Getting closer to the 50th anniversary of the war, you see less of this perception of the bunkers as symbols of war, of the evil of the Third Reich, etc. You see more of the pragmatic desire to get something useful out of them. On the 50th anniversary of the liberation of Denmark, the bunkers on the West Coast, so the Atlantic Wall, were used in a commemorative project where they strung a line of laser along the bunkers, connecting this massive fortification project and really showing how that whole long line of bunkers is connected. There's a German who's described it as a string of beads made out of reinforced concrete, which sounds surprisingly a lot more poetic in German. So because the bunkers are some of the only tangible remains from the war here in Denmark, they're an obvious choice for this commemoration, even despite the dark symbolism that some in the 80s and 90s still attributed to them. And then it kind of takes off from there. Around the 2010s, there's a couple of things happening that show just how much things have changed. A bunker is discovered washed out after a storm, which had previously been completely buried. And all of the press surrounding it is overwhelmingly positive. And you start to see this public idea that the bunkers are worthy of preservation. And then in 2013, the Agency for Culture in Denmark decides to demolish about 100 bunkers on the West Coast due to health and safety concerns, because water will erode even reinforced concrete, and then you just have like rebar sticking out of it. And given that everyone's just climbing all over them, that tends to be problematic. And the public goes nuts, basically saying that it's negligent of Danish cultural heritage. And I mean, this is despite the fact that there are thousands of bunkers along the coast. But this is just, you know, how can they destroy our cultural heritage, that kind of thing. And the work goes on regardless, because health and safety. But it really does show that shift in the perception of these bunkers from the blight on the landscape to worthy of preservation. And I mean, they've also been at this point ascribed status of worthy of preservation in the Danish cultural canon.
I find that so interesting that they actually become part of Danish culture.
Mm-hmm.
And that basically what it is that the public just absolutely, I find that so interesting. I wish more of that would happen around around other parts of Europe and other heritage sites, really.
I do genuinely think that this is partly because of our wartime experience. Like, I think it's very hard to have that kind of interaction with really, truly dark heritage.
So the perspective changes. How else are these bunkers used?
Well, because the perspective changes. So because the perspective changes, the bunkers are now considered worthy of preservation. And, you know, in some ways that hasn't changed much. Basically, the bunkers are open to the public, or they're opened to the public in 1945, and now they're still open to the public. But the point is that a fair few of them have been turned into actual official museums. So there's two really big museums on the West Coast, both created in bunker systems. One at Tirpitz, which opened a few years ago, and one at Hanstholm, which is absolutely enormous. The Hanstholm one shows the whole area, the whole local system, and it's built to protect the entrance to the Baltic from the Allies. So this is a really freaking big defense system. And the whole idea from 1945 of allowing the curious visitor to see inside the bunkers has come true, but like to the nth degree. Like, you're inside the gun emplacements. It's absolutely amazing. They're enormous structures.
I love it. I've got to tell you, I mean, we've got so many bunkers here in Poland that my dad took me as a birthday present a couple of years ago now. We went and toured.
If you're a nerd.
Yeah, I know. I'm such a nerd. Northeast part of Poland. And we went to the Wolf's Lair. And what I love my dad. He spent so much time on the internet searching for bunkers that were just not, they were available to visit, but in the sense that there weren't a lot of people going to them. And we spent a week just touring around and looking at bunkers and things. And
God, incredible. You have to come visit me. Like, I'll totally take you to the museums, but there are thousands of bunkers here. Like, you just walk into them. I mean, most of them are sanded up, so don't be claustrophobic, but yeah, just go ham.
There you go, ladies and gentlemen. If you want to go play with bunkers and you can't find anywhere you live, head towards Denmark.
Absolutely.
Or you can always give Camilla a shout on Twitter, and I'm sure she'll be happy to help you find various different bunkers. I know for a fact you've gone out there, haven't you? And you've just
mapped them,
haven't you?
Yes, it is a recurring joke between my mother and I, because she was she drove with me on my fieldwork for my dissertation, because I have an amazing mother, that every time we see any kind of concrete, we just both go, concrete, because that's what we did when I was doing my fieldwork, because they're really hard to spot when they're inland. So any patch of concrete gets exciting when you're a nerd, when you're a really, really big nerd.
So how many of these patches of concrete actually turned out to be a bunker?
Most of them, to be fair, but this is also because my fieldwork was done on a very, very small island that had like a really strategically vital role in the war. So there were a lot of bunkers.
I love it. I love this. But so moving on, there's a really official, gosh, I can't even speak today. There's a really official way to use bunkers. So what happens to the rest of them? What do people do with them?
Well, This is kind of what we were just talking about, and this is one of the things that I really love, because there are thousands of bunkers, you can't actually like use every single one in an official capacity. There's no point in turning every bunker into a museum. Now, quite a few of them are on the West Coast, but also elsewhere in Denmark. But a lot of the bunkers, especially along the West Coast, are just kind of left as they are. They're open to the public for nothing, open to exploring or for playing on. And they've become this really ubiquitous part of the West Coast, to the point where you see kids like playing on them, climbing on them, running around inside. And they're, you know, partly sanded over, buried in the dunes. So they've become part of the landscape, both figuratively and literally. But even beyond this, the bunkers are at the same time places of commemoration and connection to the war, and just empty concrete husks, like both of those simultaneously. They're covered in graffiti, you know, people just tagging whatever they want. They're used to shelter partying youth. They're full of empty beer bottles and beer cans. There's remains of bonfires. And they're also used as a framework for narratives of the war, both in the official capacity as museums, but also very much just on a casual level. Anecdotally, you know, certainly you see a bunch of Danish parents telling their kids about the war, but you also see the enormous amount of German visitors that we have on the West Coast each year, and you see them walking around the bunkers. And my German isn't perfect, but it's good enough to pick up on these parents, German parents, using the bunkers as a framework for telling their kids about the war. And I think that's really lovely, especially because in the 80s and 90s, there was this whole argument that it would be important to remove the bunkers because it might make the German tourists feel awkward, which I will say was very quickly shut down because, lol, who cares? They should not have built them in the first place then. But you do actually see the Germans interacting with them, and I think that's quite lovely. And also, some of the graffiti that gets left on the bunkers does connect deeply with the war. There's some anti-Nazi or anti-German bits, but there's a lot of messages of peace and reconciliation. Like a peace dove, which it's kind of easy, but it's also kind of sweet, the Judeo-Christian symbol for peace and rebuilding after great destruction. And also just the word forgive scrawled in a bunker in English. And I mean, they're quite shallow and quite facile messages, but because of the choice of canvas, they become intrinsically connected to the war. So even though the connection that lived through the war is dying out, and eyewitnesses to this point in history are becoming ever more rare, we connect the memory of the war to the heritage aspect of it through this interaction. And I love that. I think it's really interesting and really unusual.
Do you know, that's probably the only time I'm ever going to agree with people putting graffiti on something of a type of memorial. I think a type of memorial, let's run with that line, a type of memorial, because obviously, you know, you go to other places, cemeteries sometimes, or other places of memorial that should not even be touched, and they're being defaced by graffiti and people carving things into the wall, and people can already guess where I'm heading with this, but I'm not going to mention the name because it infuriates me when people do this. I think, yeah, this is going to be the only time that I actually agree with using graffiti in a place of memory or a place of commemoration.
Yeah, completely agree.
Right, okay. You got to have one of these. Everyone has one of these. What is your favorite bunker?
That's like asking me to choose who my favorite child is. There are certainly bunkers that have a special place in my heart. There's the first one I ever saw when I was about 12. On holidays with my granny on the West Coast, actually, you know, at 12, deeply into history and like quietly grave as I walked up to this partially buried bunker on the West Coast while my cousin and my sister played somewhere else on the beach. That was like the beginning of this whole thing. But there's also a particular bunker on the island of Fano where I did my field work, where somebody has written a poem in German that translates to "all time shall pass, all things shall vanish, so forgive and be free." And this is like, this German interaction with a site of the war has really stayed with me. I think it might be easier for us Danes to forgive because we had this much easier experience with the Second World War. But ultimately, this is an interaction between the people and their cultural heritage and their history, which is very tangible and very hands-on. It's not filtered through a museum. It's the simultaneous reverence and irreverence that I really like. The interaction with the structures as remains from the war, as a framework for the narratives of the occupation, and the way they're just part of the landscape used for graffiti, for parties, for playing on. So I suppose less of a favorite bunker and more of a favorite aspect of the way the bunkers have been sort of assimilated into our heritage. But I do also, if you'll allow me, want to leave you with a story that always gets to me.
Go for it.
One of the reasons the 50th anniversary of the liberation was commemorated with that line of light along the Atlantic Wall was to bring to mind the moment which was described by a Swedish poet just after the war, of cycling along the coast of Sweden on a spring evening in 1945 and gazing across the Sound to Denmark and seeing the lights go up across the sea for the first time since the occupation. 5 years of darkness and suddenly light as people ripped down their blackout curtains after the German forces had capitulated and let their lights into the streets. And we commemorate this every year on the 4th of May when the capitulation was announced at 8:33 p.m. by lighting candles in our windows.
Oh my God, that is actually incredibly beautiful and incredibly poetic.
I know. I love it.
That is, I think I'm going to have to come to Denmark over the 4th of May and experience that, because that's just incredible.
Please do. And I'll take you to all the fun bunkers.
Do you know what? A bunker is always fun. And do head over to Poland at some stage, because then we can go and play in the Wolf's Lair, and there's so many different places. And there's lots of bunkers on the Polish Slovak and the Polish Czech borders as well.
Oh, you know what I like.
Well, the downside is there's nowhere to get there by car, so you have to hike up a mountain just to get into the
bunker. I'm sorry, you're describing this as a problem. You do realize I hiked across my entire country last year.
See, ladies,
I mean, to be fair, that's like 10 kilometers, but you know, still, it's a lot more than that.
This is what you get when you live on an island in Denmark.
Yes.
But it's not the smallest island, though, is it?
No, it's the biggest of the islands.
But an island, nevertheless.
It's a peninsula, yes. I live, like, really close to Sweden.
Like, literally throwing stones throw away.
Well, not quite, but I live, like, within an hour of Sweden and actually an hour of Germany. This is my country, okay? It's not big.
I love it. Ladies and gentlemen, head towards Denmark, where you're going to find an experience of lovely people, good food, and of course, the most important thing of all, bunkers. So, Camilla, thank you so much for joining us. That was brilliant. Definitely.
Thank you for having me.
Come back and talk about World War II in the future.
Let's do that thing. Like, we will talk about a comparison of the Polish occupation and the Danish occupation. That shall be a thing.
I love it. That is a plan moving forward. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Don't forget that we do exist on Patreon as History Hack and on Patreon as well, which is Podbean's own version. Elena and I have had massive fun doing this in 2020, but life's going to change quite a lot next year and we're going to actually have to go and earn a living, etc. If we want to keep up the regularity that we've been bringing you and the kind of guests that we've been bringing you and the workload, then we will need your help. So if you join, there's going to be incentives for joining on either of those platforms. We're revamping ourselves on both of them. So don't forget to go in. You can do as little as $1 a month and it all goes towards keeping up History Hack as regular as we've been able to bring it to you this year.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org. where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/hackhistory, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.